From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On today's program, a security incident in Washington dominates day three of the government shutdown. We hear about today's events on Capitol Hill and talk to a Republican moderate who worries the government shutdown is tearing his party apart.
Significant damage if it continues with the spokespeople that are out there today.
Also today, more than 130 African migrants die when a boat carrying them to Europe sinks off the Italian coast. On the 53rd anniversary of Nigeria's independence, a look at the Islamic militancy threatening the country. And from San Francisco, people with HIV/AIDS choosing healthcare over housing.
People choose to remain in San Francisco and be homeless rather than to leave and die.
That's ahead on FSN Reports after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. The shooting incident that ended at the complex of the US Capitol is over. Shots were fired near Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. on Thursday afternoon, and police there have said one officer was injured and a suspect in custody. It's reportedly started when a car attempted to ram a barrier at the White House and then fled up Pennsylvania Avenue towards the domed home of the US Congress. U.S. Capitol Police say the incident involved one driver and a child in the vehicle, but can't confirm gunfire details or other injury details. Eyewitnesses say a woman was driving the vehicle, which comes just a fortnight after 12 people were killed by a lone gunman at the U.S. Navy Yard, also in Washington. Chief Kim Dine of the U.S. Capitol Police described it as an isolated incident.
The vehicle was attempted to be stopped by Secret Service Uniform Division. Shots were potentially fired. They pursued the vehicle. The vehicle came, struck one of our vehicles here at 2nd and Maryland. 2nd and first and Con here, and then ultimately ended up at 2nd and Maryland northeast, where it crashed into one of our barricades. At this time, the scene is secure. Both scenes are secured. We initially locked down some buildings in the Capitol vicinity. That lockdown has been released. We have no information that this is related to terrorism.
FSN reporter Alice Olstein spoke to Joe Brophy, a Washington pedicab driver who witnessed events near the south side of the White House.
And there was a officer, a car pulled in there by the Secret Service booths where it's not supposed to go. It looked like it was being turned around, and then they tried to stop it. A guy came out with one of those, black fences things that looked like a bike rack, to try to hold it in there. And the woman the car ran into him while he was holding it and sort of knocked him backwards. And then they ran into him again, knocked him over, and sped off.
So a woman was driving this car?
Yeah, a woman driving the car. I believe it was Connecticut plate. And then another one of my cabs was at the Capitol. And he sort of fled when he heard gunshots, and then his cab is inside the safe zone to the crime scene now, and he's waiting outside it to get it.
A chemical disarmament team in progress reports it's made encouraging initial progress. From UN headquarters in New York, our reporter Stephen Fee has more.
The team from the UN and the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons wrapped up its first full day of meetings with Syrian authorities. Within the week, the group is set to begin on-site inspections and may also begin disabling equipment used to craft chemical weapons. They're also working to verify Syria's disclosures and are planning logistics for the eventual destruction of Syria's chemical arsenal. Stephen Fee, New York.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. All of the Greenpeace activists detained in Russia have been charged with piracy. A total of 30 people from 18 different countries were detained last week in the Bachora Sea in northern Russia for an alleged attempt to seize an oil drilling platform. Greenpeace denounced the arrest as illegal and the charges as absurd. Swarms of giant hornets have killed 42 people and injured over 1,600 in China. The venomous species, the world's largest, can cause multiple organ failure. Scientists believe the spate of attacks, more commonly seen in Japan, are down to unusually dry weather conditions. Beijing-based journalist Rebecca Hume says the venom has had devastating effects.
Victims are actually finding that it's actually dissolving away at human tissue. So the actual stings go quite deep, and they're really, really quite large because, these hornets, we're talking about the size of a human thumb.
Federal agents have shut down a billion-dollar black market bazaar on the internet, where they say hitmen advertise their services and thousands of drug dealers hawk their wares. Agents say the bazaar was called Silk Road, and its mastermind used an alias from the book and movie The Princess Bride. Rachel Silverman has details.
Federal authorities say a 29-year-old physicist named Ross Ulbricht used the alias Dread Pirate Roberts to operate the hidden website Silk Road. Agents say Silk Road started as an online marketplace for drug users who made purchases using the electronic currency Bitcoin. They say Silk Road branched out to other illicit goods and services, including forged documents, computer hacking, and murder for hire. The website operated on an underground computer network known as the Onion Router that uses complicated algorithms to disguise unique internet addresses of each computer. The site now contains a banner announcement with the logos of several federal agencies and a message that says, "This hidden site has been seized." Rachel Silverman, San Francisco.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Kevin McAleese reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. We begin today with drama on Capitol Hill, where the US Congress and associated buildings were locked down after a security incident that began at the White House. A car driven by a woman tried to breach security at the White House, rammed a barrier, and was then pursued by the Secret Service through the streets of Washington towards Capitol Hill. Our correspondent Alice Olstein was in her office at the Capitol when the incident began, and she spoke to FSN's Lorna Shaddock.
I was in my office in the Dirksen Senate office building, and the Capitol Police came over the loudspeaker and told us that there were reports of gunfire, and I saw on social media that it happened just outside the building, right outside the entrance on the south side of the building. And we were told to shelter in place. We were put on lockdown, told to stay in our offices, lock all the doors, stay away from windows. And that was just lifted a few minutes ago, and we were told to go about our normal business again. This has not happened since I've been working on Capitol Hill. Obviously, the Navy Yard shooting just a few weeks ago was very scary and happened not very far from here, just a couple miles. But it's obviously pretty different than it happening just outside your office building. There were a lot of rumors immediately swirling around, everybody asking, you know, what do you know, what do you know, and reports on social media. But as we know from these previous incidents in other places, you can't always trust the first thing that you see reported, and it's best to wait for accurate information to be sorted out by the police and verified.
And what's the atmosphere like there now? Presumably still a great deal of confusion there.
There is still a bit of confusion, people trying to find out exactly what did happen and what's being done about it. Obviously, there are fewer people here right now because of the government shutdown. A lot of the Senate staff are at home on furlough. I tried checking in with people I know who work for senators, and they said, "We don't know anything. We were at home on furlough." So definitely a reduced presence here, but all of the members of Congress are here, and some of them have been tweeting that they actually heard the shots. They were outside when it happened, but that they're all safe.
Now, after the Navy Yard shooting, certainly President Obama wanted the gun control debate to be reignited. That didn't really happen. Do you think that this incident might add to that pressure?
It's possible, but honestly, right now, anything besides reopening the government is very low on the list. I know there was just a huge immigration bill introduced in the House yesterday, but that's barely getting any attention because things are just completely paralyzed here and everything is shut down. And until some sort of funding bill is passed, it's going to stay that way and everything else will have to wait.
So what happens next there up on the Hill? People now were able to leave and going about their business, but are they doing that?
The Senate and House both recessed. I don't know if they're going to reconvene this evening, but they had... Before this happened, they had plans to, you know, continue debating through tomorrow and possibly through the weekend.
Today's incident, of course, came in the midst of day three of a US government shutdown. Before it occurred, President Obama traveled to the suburb of Rockville in Maryland, where he made an impassioned case for Republicans in the House of Representatives to put the US government back to work. His backdrop, the headquarters of M. Luice Construction, one of many companies whose livelihoods the president suggested are being put at risk by the behavior of Republicans in Congress. One thing that's become apparent during the shutdown discussion is that the action by a few Republicans in the House of Representatives is deeply alarming to many Republicans elsewhere. Earlier today, I spoke to former Senator Judd Gregg of New Hampshire and asked him if the Republicans in the House are likely to heed the president's call.
I actually think it would have been more useful if he'd actually gone up the Hill and made the impassioned plea. One of the problems in this whole exercise has been that the president really hasn't been in the room until last night, and last night he was only in the room long enough to say, I'm not going to negotiate with you. In a divided government, which is what we have, we don't have a parliamentary system in this country. We have a government of checks and balances, and our government's divided. Both sides have to negotiate, and they have to sit down, they have to talk, and they have to reach agreement and consensus. And right now, unfortunately, our system is not doing that. Both sides are not negotiating. The president's not in the room, and some of my members of my party are making proposals which aren't negotiable, and which therefore they're non-starters.
So you fault the Republicans in the House for making proposals that you say are not negotiable?
I don't fault the Republicans in the House. I fault certain individuals within our party who've taken the position that the only way they're going to agree to opening the government back up is if you repeal Obamacare completely. Now, there are two issues which aren't going to occur in this discussion. One is complete repeal of Obamacare, because the president's invested in it, as is the Democratic Senate. And the other is raising taxes, which Republicans are totally invested in. But there's a lot of fertile ground in between those two positions. And there's a lot of places where they could reach agreement, which would address the fundamental issue, which is how we get our deficit and debt under control. I mean, that's the issue. And unfortunately, they aren't discussing those items. Both sides are sort of standing in their corners and shouting.
Given what you've seen over the last 3 days, given the polarization currently in this town, how long does this go on for?
Unfortunately, it pushes right up to the debt ceiling. The debt ceiling comes within a week, week and a half. And that's dangerous, because if they really wrap themselves around the wheel and we were to actually come close to default or default on the debt ceiling, that would be very serious and totally inappropriate. And it would have an impact on the world, because obviously our debt is the currency of the world. I suspect what's going to happen, and I hope what's going to happen, is that we'll reach what I would call a mini grand bargain, where the debt ceiling, the continuing resolution, and something called the sequester, which we're dealing with, which is controlling spending, are all addressed through replacement by an agreement on entitlement reform and tax reform and a pathway to tax reform. That's very possible, very doable. The president's actually put some very good ideas on the table in the area of entitlement reform. Republicans are fairly far down the road on tax reform. In the House, so I think it's a very accomplishable approach.
And when all is said and done, how much damage do you worry this experience is doing to the Republican Party?
Significant damage if it continues with the spokespeople that are out there today who are not the majority of the party either in the Congress or out where I live in New Hampshire and other places, because they're really at the fringes of the party on the issue of how you govern. They don't want to govern. They want to shout. They want to raise money for their PACs, and they want to increase their personal attention with the media. But the folks who do want to govern, and that's the majority of the party, both in the Senate and the House, understand that if you're going to govern, you've got to be willing to reach agreement. That's the way our system works.
Former Republican Senator Judd Gregg of New Hampshire. There was a tragedy today in the waters off the southern Italian island of Lampedusa. More than 130 African migrants died and many more are missing after a fire broke out on the boat that was bringing them to Europe. FSN's Lorna Shaddock spoke to reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome and asked her for the latest on the rescue operation.
Throughout the day, the Italian Coast Guard and other authorities have been scouring the water looking for any survivors. Among the dead, we have several young children, including a three-year-old, and there was also a pregnant woman who died in this disaster. The ship is believed to have included many Somali and Eritrean refugees The bodies have been lined up in an airport hangar, and one official on the island of Lampedusa said there were no more places for either the living or the dead on this island.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the profile of some of those on the boat and what might have pushed them to first place or attempt to get to Italy?
These particular refugees are understood to have boarded the vessel in Libya. There's a small window of opportunity in the summer months before the weather turns bad. We've heard reports that these people set off flares on the vessel when it got into difficulty. I even heard that they set a blanket on fire, but perhaps there was a petrol leak and the whole boat caught fire, forcing them into the water. Many of these people can't swim. And just a few days ago, we heard of another disaster where 13 migrants drowned when they tried to reach the coast of Italy and didn't quite make it either.
How well prepared is Italy and Lampedusa as well and Sicily for this surge of migrants?
Pope Francis was in Lampedusa as recently as July and condemned what he called global indifference to the extent of this tragedy. Now, Italy feels or has felt for some time that it hasn't been getting enough support from the European Union. Frontex, the border protection agency, is involved. It is looking for greater support and wants to see a more coordinated effort. One of the Catholic refugee services said today the Frontex agency needs to be beefed up to make sure that these asylum seekers make it to Europe in one piece.
Josephine McKenna, thank you very much indeed.
Herman Wallace, released from jail in Louisiana earlier this week after spending 42 years in solitary confinement, is in a hospital in New Orleans, suffering from terminal liver cancer. His attorneys say that a judge's order releasing Mr. Wallace from jail and ordering a new trial on the charges of armed robbery that originally put him there constitutes some measure of justice after a lifetime of injustice. Mr. Wallace and another still incarcerated member of the Angola Three, Albert Woodfox, were also convicted of murdering a prison officer, a crime they vigorously deny. FSN's Kevin McAleese spoke to the third member of the Angola Three, Robert King, released in 2001 after spending 31 years in jail.
I'm the only free member of the Angola Three, and we became known as the Angola Three because we were members of the Black Panther Party, and we were all, you know, sent to Louisiana State Prison in Angola, it is called, and we were subsequently convicted of a crime that the state knew that neither one of us committed. Herman and Albert were convicted, charged, and falsely convicted of the stabbing death of a correctional officer. And years later, it became obvious that Herman and Albert were convicted on flimsy evidence. There were no forensic evidence linking either to the crime. But nevertheless, they were both convicted, and they were found guilty, and they were both given a life sentences. And they were placed in solitary confinement. Being a member of the Black Panther Party, they placed me also in solitary confinement, where I was for 29 years of my 31 years in prison. And Herman is out of prison. And so we still have to focus on Albert, and we have to focus on maybe perhaps a miracle of a Herman.
You spent nearly 30 years, nearly three decades of your life in solitary confinement. Can you try and explain for people who may not be able to understand what that's like, the conditions that you were subjected to, and the mental and physical impact that length of isolation and confinement had upon you?
Yeah, that evokes a lot of emotion, being in prison, in solitary confinement, given a life sentence, a life in 35, a matter of fact, with no possibility of ever getting out of prison itself can be a stressful and a taxing situation, especially if you are in prison for a crime in which you have not committed. You are in a cell, 6x9x12, for 23 hours a day, sometimes 24. It can be pretty taxing on the system. I begin to feel that, you know, America was just one big prison, and I was just taken from minimum custody and placed into maximum security, which was a prison. And I've seen people who, you know, a lot of time come into that environment, that closed cell environment, and they kind of, you know, withdraw into themselves, go into seclusion. And I guess they go into some type of a mental state, and because, you know, they refuse any communication at all. I've seen guys really taken from the prison cell. I've seen, you know, there are guys who hang themselves, but I'm saying that that type of environment can drive a person to do all sorts of things. And I think, you know, a person have to have some type of buoyancy. And what gave me buoyancy, again, was my political belief.
Can I ask you, in your opinion, what do you think cases like that of Herman Wallace, yourself, Albert Woodfox, who remains in solitary confinement today, what do these cases tell us about the use of solitary confinement in the American penal system?
I think we have to take a good look at the prison system, and we have to equate them with slavery, and we have to see that they are morally reprehensible in solitary confinement, in the practice of solitary confinement, in long-term sentencing. People are sent to prison from now on. In Angola, if you go to Angola, 95% of the people will die there, because if you don't have a life sentence, you got insurmountable life sentence, which means that you got so much time that you cannot do it. And if you got a life sentence, you're there for the remainder of your life without the possibility of parole, probation, or suspension of sentence, without intervention of a court. So the system itself is flawed, and the system has to be changed.
More thoughts now on the release of Herman Wallace. They come from Mumia Abu Jamal, a journalist serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole in a Pennsylvania penitentiary after being convicted of the murder of a police officer, a crime he denies. His commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Herman Wallace, one of the longest held political prisoners in the world and a member of the Angola Three, is on the brink of freedom after a federal court granted his habeas corpus and vacated his bogus murder conviction. Herman, 72 years old, now becomes the second of the Angola Three to have their wrongful convictions reversed, paving the way for Albert Woodfox, who remains under the claws of the state. The Angola Three have spent more time in solitary confinement than almost any men in America, over 41 years after the three then young men were charged with murder to cover up the real reason for their draconian banishment to the hole for life, what Louisiana officials termed Black Pantherism. Despite the fact that no reliable evidence exists to support the murder charge, there is abundant evidence to prove that the Angola Three, Robert King, Albert Woodfox, and Herman Wallace, were targeted by Louisiana for being revolutionaries, for being members of the Black Panther Party, and for being bold enough, courageous enough, to organize a branch of the Black Panther Party in the very bowels of Angola State Penitentiary back in the 70s. The late L.A. Deputy Minister of Defense, Geronimo Zizaga Pratt, once called them the most courageous Panthers of them all, for daring to organize in the heart of Angola, a former slave plantation. For their political beliefs and affiliations, they were consigned to living death in Angola's hole for over 40 years. Herman's win is bittersweet, as it comes the very year that the 72-year-old was diagnosed with liver cancer, terminal liver cancer. What kind of system damns three innocent men to decades in dungeons? The kind we live in. Herman's almost home. He's in a hospital. Albert remains waiting. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
Now, as Nigeria marks 53 years of independence, the country is still reeling from the recent murder of 41 college students. Islamic militants from Boko Haram entered the victims' dormitories before gunning them down as they slept. Terrorist attacks are on the rise in Nigeria's northeast, despite an intense military crackdown. Felix Kwoye, a journalist with Nigeria's Guardian newspaper, says his nation is in a period of transition.
Some people believe that the nation ought to have moved forward or faster than what it is, and that we should have been in some places where we have not been able to make. But we believe that these are challenges of nation building, and that our challenges are not insurmountable, including the uprising, the killings, and other criminal activities that seem to have taken the charge in Nigeria. We believe that Nigeria is passing through its own stage with the hope that with time we surmount these challenges and we'll be able to move on as a nation.
President Goodluck Jonathan, he said he recognised the deep divisions in Nigeria, ethnically, religiously, politically, materially. Is Nigeria potentially walking towards civil war?
Nigeria is made up of several nationalities, different cultural, socioeconomic backgrounds. All of us have grievances. All the time has actually come for us to sit down and talk. And in fact, he announced to the nation that a committee had already been set up. So to work out the modalities for sitting down together and dialogue as a nation, people from different backgrounds, ethnic nationalities, and all of us will come down. If you are in the majority, you are a minority, and all of that will sit down and renegotiate the basis of living together as a people.
Journalist Felix Kwoye on the line from Lagos in Nigeria. Finally today, we travel to the streets of San Francisco, where thousands of residents with HIV/AIDS are being forced to choose between access to healthcare and access to a home. While San Francisco has some of the most advanced HIV/AIDS medical facilities in the world, it's also got some of the world's highest housing costs. As FSN's Rachel Silverman reports from our San Francisco bureau, that means many in the city living with HIV/AIDS are homeless.
A growing and often desperate set of San Franciscans, the thousands who are HIV positive or who have full-blown AIDS. They get enviable medical care and have no place to live but the street.
This is the only place that they have the expertise to keep us alive. And so people have to choose between medical care and housing. And so what happens is people choose to remain in San Francisco and be homeless rather than to leave and not have access to medication and die.
Basinger puts much of the blame for his clients' homelessness on U.S. fiscal policies, banks, and greedy landlords.
They've picked winners and losers, and unfortunately in San Francisco, the winners are wealthy people and the losers are people with HIV and AIDS and other vulnerable communities.
64-year-old Tim Oviatt describes his descent into homelessness.
I'm kind of a victim of the perfect storm. I had a business in the Castro, and corporate America found out that there were a lot of gay dollars out there, which drove up the rents. And my landlady of 31 years raised my rent in the recession.
Oviatt gave up his business and after some time found a job selling housewares. But he says even working full time, he couldn't afford one room in a hotel or a shared house.
Mainly I slept in my car.
What was that like?
Pretty cold. It's the winter. And at one point my battery died and I couldn't even heat the car up.
The AIDS Housing Alliance has helped Oviatt and many others who never thought they'd be homeless to find shelter. But even so, Oviatt says, it's not easy.
I only bring home net about $1,000 a month, and my room is $850 a month. Luckily, Catholic Charities is helping me with a $250 stipend a month. So, but it's $600, and then with that, I have to buy food, I have to buy gas for the car, some medications. It's pretty tough.
With the second highest housing costs in the United States, homelessness for HIV/AIDS patients in San Francisco is an epidemic. At more than 9%, the city has the highest homeless rate of people with HIV and AIDS in the United States. Rachel Silverman, San Francisco.
And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. A reminder that if you want to get in touch with the folks at Free Speech Radio News, whose program long filled this time slot on many radio stations, you can reach them via their website at fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can get in touch with us by email. We are at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. Coming up tomorrow, the American Latinos turning to Islam. That's tomorrow, but for now, I'm Simon Marks in Washington. Our program was produced today by FSN's Kevin McAleese. For everyone with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.